Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I am always amazed when I have to write a blurb well before I actually write my presentation that I, without looking at the blurb again, I still write the presentation so it fits it. And that, I'm like, I was working on this. Go, oh, this is really good. I like it. And then I looked at the blurb and I said, oh, that's what I said I was going to do. So it somehow stays with you. Okay, so I got kind of a long story to start out for you. I'm just going to get into it. And it is leading somewhere, I assure you. Okay, so for over a decade, a colleague of mine, Sue Cinnamon, and I have been offering a course on congregation-based spiritual direction. The format of the course was three three-day in-person sessions spread out over the course of the church year. 1 3-day session in the fall, another in the winter, and a final session in late spring. We had originally envisioned the course as being specifically for ordained ministers. That's because we believed, and still believe, that the training ministers get in seminary gives them almost everything they need to be spiritual directors, except for the actual nuts and bolts of what spiritual direction is and what spiritual directors do. Yeah, I thought that was funny. When I wrote it, that might be funny. So, good. I didn't write it to be funny. I just read it again. I thought, that sounds kind of funny. This is especially important when we're talking about the difference between pastoral counseling and spiritual direction. I once explained the difference like this. If someone comes to a minister with a problem to be solved, they're in need of a pastoral counselor. If the presenting issue is a mystery to be explored, they could use a spiritual director. The program was fairly successful. Over 100 ministers participated in the program during the first 7 or 8 years. And naturally, we made some modifications over the course of time, the most important being that we began to include other religious professionals, like religious educators in the program, as well as qualified lay people, primarily those who had training as social workers or marriage and family therapists. We also changed the format from the 3 3-day sessions to a week-long retreat held in a lovely retreat center outside Cincinnati, Ohio. We even added a component for youth and young adults. Things were going well until COVID-19. We had to cancel the retreat we had scheduled for August 2020, but we quickly pivoted to offering the original multi-session format as an online experience. And once again, the program was a success. With a first cohort of over 20 participants of ages ranging from young adults in their 20s to elders in their 70s. The second time we offered the course, however, the number of participants was under a dozen or so. Perhaps Zoom fatigue had already started to set in on folks. Still, that iteration didn't feel like a failure for us because the number of participants, the low number of participants, made the experience much more intimate, and we were able to go deeper in the conversations we had during our live online sessions. Now, since the beginning of the Congregation-Based Spiritual Direction program, we've always reserved some space in the second or third session or in the last few days of the retreat to talk about how important it is for a spiritual director to be aware of any biases or prejudices they may have that could influence how they respond to a directee. One of the tools we used to help participants become aware of this was the idea of cultural competency. Cultural competency is expressed in ways that recognize the value of the diverse worldviews and cultures of other people, their behavior, spirituality, beliefs, customs, language, attitudes, gender, social status, economic status, and so on. And a key factor in this ability is an awareness of one's own culture. And for those of us, like me, who are part of the dominant culture of the United States, this requires at least some understanding of what is known as white supremacy culture, a form of racism centered upon the belief that white people are superior to people of other racial backgrounds, and that whites should politically, economically, and socially dominate non-whites. There are two things I want to be very clear about here. One is acknowledging that just because someone is part of a dominant culture in the United States, a culture built on white supremacy and still continues to politically, economically, and socially benefit white people over non-white people, that does not mean that any individual white person is automatically a white supremacist. So when Sue and I talked about white supremacy culture with our participants, we weren't accusing anyone of being a white supremacist. The other thing I want to be clear about is that we talked about white supremacy culture because we truly believe that in order to be a competent spiritual director, one must be aware of how their culture can influence how they respond to someone who is coming to them for spiritual direction. I bring this all up because when Sue and I began to cover the topic of cultural competency and white supremacy culture during that second, more intimate iteration of our online program, one of the participants, a therapist by trade, pretty much told us that they were sick and tired of being told by the UUA that they were some kind of racist. In fact, they felt like their entire congregation was being labeled as racist. And they said something like, if there was one thing I could always count on when I came to my UU congregation, it was that I was among good people. And now we're being told that we're not good people. And I don't know how much longer I can be part of this association. As I mentioned earlier, Sue and I were in no way accusing any one person in the class of being racist or white supremacist. And we certainly weren't bringing it up because the UUA required us to talk about it. But this participant reacted as if we were doing both of those things, that we were somehow required by the UUA to label them as a racist. This experience came immediately to my mind when I started doing research for this presentation on the eighth principle of Unitarian Universalism, most of which I have to share with you this morning, comes from their website, thprincipleuu.org. That's where you can find the official wording of the proposed eighth principle of Unitarian Universalism. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying toward spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. And on this page of that website, you can find sections like where did this come from originally, why now, why the UUA, parentheses USA, why single out racism, what is beloved community, and what does it mean to be accountable. It was in the first section, where did this come from originally, that brought the story I just shared immediately to my mind. This section says that after working with congregations on racial justice and building beloved community for over 15 years, Paula Cole Jones, one of the two authors of the Eighth Principle, realized that a person can believe they are being a good UU and following the seven principles without thinking about or dealing with racism and other oppressions at the systemic level. This is exactly what I heard from the participant in the Congregation-Based Spiritual Direction Program. This person is a member, a leader, a worship coordinator of a UU congregation somewhere in the United States. I decided to check on whether or not their congregation had adopted the eighth principle. Not surprisingly, they hadn't. What's more, when I looked at their congregation's website, I found out that this former student of mine identifies as a defender of the UU's seven principles. Thank you. As such, they are, as you might suspect, against the proposed changes to Article 2 of the UUA's bylaws that I think Margaret led a presentation on that last week. Yeah. I mention this because I think it demonstrates how entangled these two initiatives are. I just changed the word. I had interconnected there, and that's not what they are. They are entangled. They're quite a little mess. And I mean that in a positive way, like quantum entanglement, you know, when two particles get together, they both are affected by that. So I'd like to explore a bit of this entanglement this morning. So one way the eighth principle and the changes to Article 2 are entangled is their origins. The eighth principle, which according to the website I mentioned earlier, started a little before 2013 when Bruce Pollock Johnson, the other author of the eighth principle, put together an initial draft, and he and Paula Cole Jones worked with a group of anti-racist activists in the old Joseph Priestley district of the UUA to refine it. Since then, the eighth principle has been a grassroots movement being adopted by one congregation or UU-affiliated organization at a time. As of February 24th, of this year, 282 congregations or organizations have adopted the eighth principle. In our region, the eighth principle has been adopted by over 80% of the states that make up Mid-America, including Illinois, Kentucky, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, Iowa, Missouri, Ohio, Kansas, and Minnesota. And the only states that haven't had congregations that adopted it are North Dakota and South Dakota, and there are only like five congregations in both of those states together. So the origins of the proposed changes to Article 2 of the UUA's bylaws started with the group most affected by those bylaws, the UUA's Board of Trustees. That's their document about who they are and what their purposes are, and that Article 2 is primarily for them as the governing body of the UUA. Okay, so the first mention of the current review of Article 2 in the UU World, our official denominational magazine, is a brief item from June of 2017 that reads, "The Unitarian Universalist Association's Board of Trustees will appoint a commission to review Article 2 of the UUA bylaws, which describes the UUA's purposes and principles." That's what it's there for. UUA bylaws mandate a review of Article 2 every 15 years and allows the board to appoint a commission to do so at any time. At a General Assembly session on June 24th at General Assembly in 2017 in New Orleans, delegates voiced desire to talk more in depth about UUA identity, which the commission will facilitate. The commission will be appointed by the board's at the board's October meeting, said Trustee Greg Boyd. So, the work of revising Article 2 of the UUA's bylaws began in the summer of 2017, about 5 years or so after the beginning of the Eighth Principle Project. And while the Eighth Principle represents a grassroots movement, revising Article 2 is an official act by the UUA's governing body. The motivation for the Eighth Principle came from UUs who held no official power at the associational level, while the Article 2 revisions were mandated by the association's bylaws. And there is another way where the Eighth Principle and Article 2 revisions are entangled: Paula Cole Jones. Paula Cole Jones, who I've known for over 20 years, is both one of the authors of the Eighth Principle and a member of the Article 2 Study Commission, the group that actually came up with the proposed changes to the UUA's bylaws that delegates will be voting on at this year's General Assembly. The fact that Paula Cole Jones has been involved with both initiatives can be a little confusing. Congregations that have yet to vote on adopting the Eighth Principle might wonder if they still need even bother to do it, since the revisions of Article 2, if passed the General Assembly, do not contain the current seven principles, although much of the language of the seven principles is still in those proposed changes. I heard Paula Cole Jones speak about this, And she says that she wants congregations to continue to work on adopting the eighth principle, even though the future of the seven principles is unsure. That's because if the revisions don't pass at this year's General Assembly, then the work of the eighth principle project will expand from encouraging congregations and UU-related organizations to adopt it to asking the entire association to adopt it at General Assembly. And if the Article 2 revisions do pass at this year's General Assembly, Paula Cole Jones says she feels that the language of those revisions include the most important parts of the Eighth Principle, especially under the value, Article 2 proposal has values rather than principles, and one of the values is justice, which reads, we work to be diverse, multicultural, beloved communities where all thrive. We covenant to dismantle racism and all forms of systemic oppression. So that's one of the changes. Okay, so basically there are just a few options that congregations can do regarding the eighth principle. They can, the proposed eighth principle, they can ignore it. And less than a third of the member congregations of the association have adopted it, and probably a much smaller number have spent time and energy and voted no on it, so the majority of UU congregations haven't engaged with it yet, okay? Or two, spend the time and energy to explore the eighth principle and actually vote on it. Whatever the outcome of the vote, the Eighth Principle Project has raised awareness about building a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions of accountability, accountably dismantling racism and other oppressions in ourselves and in our institutions. So just having the conversation is a success in some ways. And the same is true for Article 2. Some congregations might be ignoring the changes and not discussing it in their congregations ahead of time and just sending their delegates off to General Assembly where they might find out there's a vote on that for the very first time once they get there. That's not what you have been doing, so that's great. You have taken option two to have a conversation about the revisions to Article 2, and your delegates can make an informed decision, or I don't know what you're planning to do. But some congregations are telling the delegates, this is what we as a congregation would like to see. It sounds like that's what you're doing. Is that what you're doing? Okay. I think that's fine too. The great news is that you are already doing this work, having the conversations about both the Eighth Principle and the Article 2 revisions. You are engaged, and I think that's about all anyone can ask of you. So I was pleased to be asked to speak to you today. My goal is to support you as you make these decisions. That said, I'm wondering if there are any questions you might have about the future of the Eighth Principle, the current seven principles, and the proposed changes to Article 2.
Where am I wrong?
I support the Eighth Principle?
Yes.
Yes. That's right. And you can adopt the Eighth Principle, keep the seven principles, and have that part of your congregation's bylaws if that's the way you want to approach it. So yes, I was going to go a little bit more into the options, and that was one of them. You know, do the Eighth Principle and don't support the Article 2. You know, that's one of the options a congregation can do. Yes, correct. No, there's nothing like that at all. Because two reasons. One, congregational polity, and the UUA really can't tell you what to do. It's up to you as a congregation. That's, you know, the power for congregations resides in the congregation, not at the level of the UUA. And we are an association of congregations, but what you have in your governing documents, what you support at General Assembly or not, that is all up to you in your congregation. That's one reason. The second reason, like I said, to me, as somebody who works for the UUA, just having the conversation means we're doing the work, right? So the fact that you've talked about it and made a decision, that's our governance structure working. You know, that's the way it's supposed to work. So that we're pleased with that, you know, and that's why we do the votes. So, and also I do believe they don't they won't be keeping track or anything like that as well. You know, it's not going to be a factor afterwards. Yeah. So did you ask about the Minnesota congregations?
Yes.
Is that what I heard?
Numbers.
Yeah. I don't have the exact numbers. There's a long list that's chronological, but not geographical. You know, so I just was going through to see who's adopted it. I can say small and large congregations have adopted it. Were you wondering about how they might be using it too?
So the second.
Being accountable to it?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's an internal thing. They're saying, we voted for this. We said that we are going to be actively involved in this, and we're going to be accountable to each other around this. And it also means we're going to be accountable to the people who have been oppressed by systemic racism in our country and in perhaps our congregation. So I will say one of the larger congregations in the UUA and in Minnesota is First Unitarian Church in Minneapolis. And they've for a long time have worked very hard in doing intentional anti-racism work. And I think they would say their accountability is to themselves, within their congregation and to any partners they might have in doing that work. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of resources in the Twin Cities. There's a lot of people to partner with around this work. But I think that accountability piece is like you're not just gonna pass it and put it on the shelf. You amongst yourselves are gonna say, okay, how are we gonna live this out? We voted for it, how are we gonna live it out? And also, how are we gonna live it out in our community? What other groups are there here that we can partner with and be accountable to? So that's how I interpret it. And I did say that on that webpage, they do have a section on accountability. And I don't know if you've actually seen it. Basically, that is being accountable. Well, I'll just read it to you if there's time. It's short. White UUs hold themselves accountable to communities of color to make sure whites do what they say they will do. So that's that. If you make partnerships, you're accountable to the people you're making partnerships with. In practice, that may mean having a people of color caucus within congregations, regions, etc., to discern and express needs and concerns to the rest of the community. So making opportunities, if you do have people of color in your congregation, giving them room to be amongst themselves and then be able to, you know, feel free to come and tell their co-religionists, you know, what they have discerned and listen to them and then be accountable to that process of having them come to you, you know. They also mentioned that Black UUs hold each other accountable and help each other see and dismantle signs of internalized racism, so it's not just about white people. And we need an effective mechanism to structure or ensure this, similarly with other oppressions. So I think that's kind of what I was getting to with those partnerships, right? We need to be working with people that want to hold us accountable, okay? And then there goes way back to the Cambridge platform amongst Unitarians is congregations hold each other accountable too. So, you know, ministers might gather and talk about the work they're doing, you know, and, you know, it's like that. So that's how I kind of understand accountability. I hope that's helpful.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a good question. And they've been using that word for ages. I remember maybe it was the 90s, a UU World cover was talking about dismantling structural racism, and there was a crane, you know, picking up things like that. So it's kind of what you're saying. But that's a good question. You know, that's the question you ask each other. You know, what does that mean for us? You know, if we want to engage in this, what does that mean for this religious community in this wider community? But that's a good point. I appreciate it. And I miraculously came prepared for that question. The UUA has started something called Mosaic, and it is one place on the UUA website where all these resources are supposed to be collected. And one of the things they wanted to do was develop a certification program similar to the Welcoming Congregation program, emphasizing lifespan learning and diversity, equity, inclusion, and anti-oppression. And this is this is being developed now, but it's kind of is focusing on just kind of all areas of the congregation and how to engage in this work. So it's called Mosaic. I think you can find UUA Mosaic. It will take, I think it'll take you to the page where it talks about that. But it's, I agree with you, and this has been a difficulty. We haven't developed consistent, clear resources around this. And that's something that even in the staff groups, they've been trying to say, what exactly do we need to be doing? And we're moving towards that. But this Mosaic, the website, is supposed to be the place where all these resources are going to be, but including this certification program that congregations can actually engage in. Not ready yet, but they've laid out what it will look like. Yeah. Thank you. And I'll just say quickly, Sue and I are working on something that would be three things. One of them would be starting with what we call mental health first aid, because that will help people deal with folks in the sort of like the most intense sort of situations. But as you learn how to do that, you learn how to engage with people around issues of spirituality and things like that. The next one would actually be about training to do spiritual care for one another. And then the last session would be about engaging the entire congregation. And at the end, you would get a certificate in something like communal spiritual care or something like that. So I hope that sort of answered your question. And hopefully that'll be available next fall. So you'll hear more about that. Woo. All right, thank you. Great to be here. The dominant culture.